As I said earlier, so I'm trying very hard to have this discussion as much as possible without reference to Rav Kook, which I think is cheating, because it's hard to find anything that you can't find some kind of optimistic basis for in Rav Kook, and I don't really understand the basis of it. So this is a little bit of cheating, because Rav Ariel is clearly coming from that universe, but I think it ties into philosophic issues that are more definable in a way that makes it valuable. And also, if we want to get a sense of what the potential space for art and discussions of art are in Orthodox culture, we have to know what the contemporary discussions are. And so there isn't so much going on in America. If you were at the Orthodox Forum, you know how limited the discussion really is. There's a lot more going on in Israel, but the discussion in Israel tends to take place, the halachic discussion in Israel tends to take place in the kind of framework set up by this introduction. So I think it's worth reading and talking about what the presumptions are here, and what it would mean about art, and then we'll go back and look at Plato, and see what Plato says about it. So he begins by giving him the usual yashikoch for the book, and then he says as follows: "Ho'emanut ve'emunah kruchot zu bezu." All right, so it's a really optimistic statement. Right, art and faith are intertwined. "Ve'emunatenu ha'monotheistit ve'hamufshetet." Okay, so here we go for the, right, taking the issue on its teeth. You might think that because we are a monotheistic incorporealist religion, so we would be opposed to art, which is all about the creation of images. We could see us as an iconoclastic religion, so to speak. Nope. Right, it's precisely our incorporealist monotheism that compels us to engage in art. Okay, haketzad, right? So how is it possible, right? Under what circumstances is it the case that Judaism's specific form of incorporealist monotheism, right, requires the engagement in art? So he begins by saying that there are with descriptions of Christianity and Islam, right? And he has no need for apologetics. Right, so there's no pluralism, and we're all equal here, and all different perceptions. No, there's Christianity and Islam. They are both offshoots of our religion, and they both make errors. Christianity is described as anatrut irva demunat hayichud yisodot paganiim eliliim chushniim uprimitivim. Right, so Christianity interweaves with our religion, pagan idolatrous. I guess the gross, sensible, primitive, sensual, maybe, aspects of religion, which he says that's avodah zarah. All right, he takes the halachic position that in fact Christianity is in fact avodah zarah. Right, he is.
Is this him actually thinking that halachic
position? I think so. I think so. But he made paskin that it's not technically avodah zarah for Christians, right? Because he says michal shituf lo yatza, and that sounds like a hint.
So he doesn't know
who owns the book that he bought, that he robbed, and make sure that. No, there are many, many ways out of it. There are no nafkaminas. Other than perhaps walking into churches, right? On that kind of daily life issue of whether Christianity is avodah zarah or not, particularly if you take the intermediate position that it's the kind of avodah zarah that is not forbidden for Gentiles. My presumption is that he takes that position, because in order to not take that position, you have to believe that the word shituf in Tosfot is irrelevant to polytheism. Since he uses the word shituf to mean some kind of polytheism, or joint divinity, whatever you want to call it, so it seems clear to me that he takes the position attributed to Tosfot. You can read my piece, which I think is not the position of Tosfot, and that's an old dispute. I don't think that position has any existence in the Rishonim.
What's the date of this?
Ariel?
Yeah.
2 years ago. Tashin Tamach Bet. How long ago was that? Yeah. 9 years ago. Right. Okay. Sorry, now I'm translating in my head. Okay. On the other hand, Islam, right? Le'imata, tiher datzma mikol shemet elilut. Right? So Islam is unquestionably a non-pagan, right, religion. Olam hu katzin l'katzeh sheni, but they went extremist in the other position, monotheismus, monotony. Right? I don't know, he thinks monotonous, but yeah, I guess in visual imagery we would say a monochromous or something like that. Right? Single color religion. Monochromatic. Yeah, well, I'm trying to do it in Hebrew. which he says, Hamiskachesh lametziut hachaya hamiguzenet. It weakens the diverse, right, the diverse existence which a human being who has senses finds themselves in. Right, so he thinks that monotheism fails that Islamic monotheism fails to appreciate the potential richness of sense experience is probably a fair way of framing it. Okay, right, and he says that these two. These two extreme approaches to religion, although they're only extreme relative to us, because obviously there's an extreme of paganism that is much more, that goes a lot beyond the way he describes Christianity, generate two radically different approaches to faith, or to art, right? So he says, "Hakitzanut hanotrit hamorida u'mashpilat elokut l'rama hushanit hagasa shelanu." Right? So Christianity, he believes, diminishes divinity by reducing it to the sensual and the perceptual. But Islam, on the other hand, natala ketzeh hasheni, emunato sholelet kol dmut chaya, lo basar v'dam, lo behema, lo eitz, lo perach, ela rak motivim melachutim shel turod handasiyot v'arabaskot. Right? But Islam bans all representational arts. I can't tell you if he's correct about what, you know, I've read that there are conflicting positions in Islam as there are in halakha. Okay, but his understanding of the thrust of Islam is that Islam has gone in the opposite direction and it only permits abstractions. And it doesn't even permit representational abstractions from its perspective. It only permits ornamental abstractions. Although we don't know, perhaps it permits conceptual abstractions. As long as you're not intended to represent something directly, so his summary of this is Hanatrut hishpila et elukut, haIslam dikei et anoshiyut, elu veelu einam divrei Elokim chayim. And certainly he can write. Christianity diminishes divinity. Islam diminishes humanity. Right, but the true religion exalts both, and reaction to both the Christian and Islamic failure is what generates what we call contemporary Western culture. Right, kenegdan notra reaktia chamura lo pachot hatarbut ha'maaravit ha'achshavit ein la, right, which has ein la lo el velo ideal velo shum mechuyavut shum achrayut Ela matan dror lagas laparei vela bulgari la, which is that? What's that word? Pankisti? Pankisti? Not sure what that word is. Ending in the anarchisti. Okay, so there, right? So his depiction of art history is that the goal of art is to present something which both maintains divinity at its true level, and allows, right, and appreciates the capacity of humanity for diverse sense perception. The two dominant religions of Western culture have failed at one end or the other. The reaction to that is a Western art culture which refuses to accept boundaries at all. Okay, and it's the reaction to all this that Judaism will come through. All right, this is where we come in. Okay, Brian?
Hi, I have a question. I didn't exactly understand. Is his point that Western culture is therefore similar to Christianity in the sense that it has no limit on representation?
Western culture just thinks, I think his argument is Western culture just, right, because it does not see the boundaries of either Christianity or Islam,
mm-hmm.
allowing the production of what should be art should be, so it simply has rejected the whole notion that religion can tell it what art should be, right? So we get the Oman HaModerni Eino Mukhan Lishmoa Tzamilim Hamanut Tzricha Hamanut Chayevet Ki Ein Lo Mechuyavut Lishum Davar. Okay, right. So v'umnato lo tricha lo dato liot meshubedet l'shem davar. Okay, right. So the flaw, right, ta'utohu, he v'kach shu re'e v'amanut mashu meshabed chitzoni and heteronomy. Okay, so the claim is that, so right now, artists have rejected the authority of religion because they find both Christianity, which prevents you from portraying divinity properly, and Islam, which prevents you from portraying humanity properly, right? They find them both as impositions, and the right, and therefore art objects to any notion that imposes obligations on it. Right? The statement art requires is offensive, because. Because the claims of religion are seen as enslaving, and subordinating, and constricting, and other imposed and heteronomous, as opposed to necessary elements of the production of art. Okay, but emuna amitit, but true faith, eina magbila v'eina meshabedet. It doesn't bound and it doesn't constrict, and it doesn't subordinate. He novad me emet hapnimit amuka shel adam atmo umaftia b'tzira chavshit et amiti ha'amuk v'amutisha be'adam. Right? But true faith does not subordinate. Rather, true faith comes from the truth that is in the depth of, right, the truth that is in the depth of every human being. And therefore, right, and really, what true faith enables you to do, what real art should be, in this perception, is that it should be capable of freely representing the truth. Hadam nivra b'tzelem, right? Since because human beings are created b'tzelem elokim, arachav, so his values are shifotav and his yearnings, right? Emunato ve'umunato, right? His faith and his art, right? And his aesthetics. Shoafim l'malos, they all yearn for the above. Elam muchlat hanitzchi v'hamushlam hayafeh v'hatohor. Haneshama ha'tohorah mevatat kol tchusha kol tofa'a v'chush ha'amnuti ha'amiti shela. Estetika v'etika chadhu etzla. Adinata eina misugelet l'alimut l'gasut l'ashbalat guf adam ela netzal l'yafeh v'lamiromam. Okay, so the claim is that any conflict between aesthetics and ethics is illusory, because really aesthetics and ethics come from the same place in the human being. And so true religion could not possibly constrain art. So long as art is attuned to truth, then it could not possibly be in conflict with religion. And the true human being is always, right, here you can hear Rav Kook in the background, right? The true human being is always seeking to rise upward. It's a little bit more optimistic than the Drashot Haran, who thinks that human beings are are composed of lot of both earth and spirit, and so parts of us try to go up and parts of us try to go down. But here I always love quoting the problem with this image. My modern day school once, in an inspired moment, launched a public relations campaign which said, quote, "My modern days, we understand that children do not only need wings, they also need roots." And so I have this permanent image in my head of a tree with wings flapping them but going nowhere. So the truth is, once you have roots, wings don't help at all. It's just not. It's a very unfortunate mixed metaphor.
Pardon? That's
Yeah, if it's rooted, it's rooted. Once you're rooted, you don't need twigs, no help.
It's rooted, but then there's like strings such that
it can be tethered, right? That's the one. Flapping at a tether. I don't know. I don't know. It sort of struck me as like, you know, here we turn all our students into lead balloons. It just didn't work at all. We felt very sad for the students going like this. Not being able to go anywhere. Any case. So, but in Rav Kook, you get very little of the gravitational pull of the soul. Yes. Let's finish what he's saying in a minute. Okay. Okay. Now the problem is, since we of course have the true religion, which has the capacity to the proper understanding of both God and human beings, so we should be living in infinite museums, because we should have been producing art that does all this all along. So we need an explanation for why it is this religion, which not only is not opposed to art, but necessitates art. Why is it that we have such a poor visual tradition? So there is an easy explanation. The easy explanation, of course, is galut. Right? Nifnei chataenu galina me'artenu. Okay, so begalut hitrachakne me'artenu mimekomenu ativi dalal mayani tziratenu amnutit kinutach misivato mimekor hashraato shugam shamayim migam arti. Okay, really, because really we can only have this proper sense when we're in Israel. But now, here we go, right? So, im shuvenu l'artzenu, hechel lachzor elenu gam chushenu ha'esteti. Okay, right? But now that we have returned to Israel, now our aesthetic sense is back. Okay, not clear that he believes you could produce art in chutz la'aretz. But in Israel, right, our aesthetic sense is back. The whole question, right, maybe if you go to art school in Israel for a year, right, so you can take that back and bring back your culture, and we can all live vicariously. Yeah.
I was just wondering, does he mean that in like some sort of metaphysical sense in Galut, or is he saying that literally, like, there were, for whatever reasons, other influences that prevented us from doing art?
I think it has great, great hesitation. I think that if you live in Rav Kook's world, that distinction is an illusion. Right? There are no accidents.
Right.
Things distract you in Chutz La'aretz, because it is the nature of Chutz La'aretz to be distracting. And those things can be political or they can be metaphysical. The boundaries between those categories are not distinct. Right, if you were painting it, right? Right, you're trying to, it would be an edge, it would not be a line, exactly right. Okay. Ulam utzarenu notim amanenu lechakot et ofanot haolamiyot hamitkachshot la'atzmiyotenu levruchenu letarbetenu amikorit umekeven she'enehem parzalot letarbut hamaravit kashelem lishtachrer mishnei motivim hamushrashim amuk betarbut hamaravit hamotiv ha'elili hanotri mikan Reaktia negdo hamitbatat balimut and chashpanut. Okay, so we can't get out of the. Unfortunately, our artists are not able to escape Western culture, either the initial Christian influence or the reaction, right, or the reactions to it, which are on the one hand anarchy and on the other hand censorship. V'hitparkut me'idach b'limut toldot amanut ein lichlol natrut v'chashpanut rachashpanut, I'm not sure what that word is. Heina normot ha'me'udot mefrach amanut tova arakit emanit. Okay. Yesh amnam hechreach l'dad al kiyuman tre ein likachesh l'hashpatan amet. So you have to study art history, because if you don't study art history, you can't understand why Western culture went wrong. And so it's very important to understand art history so you can understand what went wrong. Ulam mitoch emdat bikoret nokevet V'idya mechlala bilvad. But the whole purpose is to launch a severe, harsh, or a severe criticism, and you really only need to understand the general issues. There's no point in studying the specifics.
Wait, what is the specific then? Are
you don't need to, right, you're not interested in knowing, right, you don't need to know the paintings. You need to understand what went wrong. L'mat zod yesh lakir gam tarbiyot achirot, kigon islamit v'mizrachit. Even though the Eastern art also has many pagan motifs, which is worth going on. Ulam kamur, gam ha'islam le'yomdenu ketel levatei emunateinu ha'choshit v'amekorit. Okay, so it's worth being aware of Islam and Eastern religion also, although Eastern religion has idolatrous impact, and you can't really learn from Islam how to do the truly free art, which is our art. Right? There is no freedom outside Judaism. So b'derech ha'melech ne'lech, lo nita yamin u'smol, ela nidlev v'nishtem mi'be'irenu ha'mikorit, we will drink only from our own wells, lo mi'borot nishparim asher le'achilu ha'mayim, very nice, lo nichna, lo nitrapes l'chol asher kuna o mechuna b'shem amanut b'ofna, lo lilut v'lo limut, lo chashpanut v'lo metidanut, ela me'hayafe v'hatov ha'adina v'shubach sh'padabit ha'olam nilmod, l'fatech amanut yisraelit mikorit. Okay, so this is the right. So his haskama to this collection of responsa on art and halakha is a manifesto about the need for an authentically live Jewish art, a statement of the parameters of what live Jewish art should be, which is that it is capable of expressing the divine without physicalizing it, and capable of expressing humanity without metaphysicalizing it. Right? Human beings have to be left in the realm of the senses. You have to express the Tzelem Elokim in its capacity to live in a differentiated sense perceptual world, and the point of this is that art should not see religion as imposed on it, and art should see it as the expression of true religion. Now, what he doesn't tell you is what this has to do with halakha. Right? It begins with the Yashar Koach and putting out a collection of shutim. It ends with the Yashar Koach and putting out a collection of shutim. But it doesn't in any way say how the notion of a collection of halachic responsa relates to the image of religion as freeing as opposed to constraining art.
Did the person who wrote the book?
I don't know.
Did you put it in the
title? Yeah, but it sells books. Or even, look, you know, if you get a haskama from people who don't agree with you, that means that people who don't agree with you are more likely to read your book. So why, you know, so you have no, you can put us, you know, many haskamas say, I never read the book. Right, this one doesn't even pretend. Doesn't even say, I looked at the book. It just says, Yashar Koach. The only reference to the books are, Yashar Koach al Sifrecha ha'osek b'sheilot ma'asiyot b'tchum omanut. Right, long essay on what I think Amunut is, ending, Yashar Koach al etzem hayuzma lechaber sefer b'nosei Amunut, v'al tochno hechashuv v'hamealev. Right, so we know, right, so we have no idea what happened, except we know that everybody else thinks it would be a good idea to write a Jewish book about art, to write a religious Jewish book about art. So it's a fair question, whether if Ariel actually read the book, if he would approve of it. And whether the author, I tend to think that the author probably shares much of this position, because I think ecstatic, the romantic school of religious Zionism. I think that's not a bad description of the followers of Rav Kook, especially those who still have a real connection to Rav Yitzchak HaKohen Kook, and not just to Ritz Vihuda. I think it's not, right. They come out of a romantic movement, and that's right. A romantic movement is all about authenticity, and a belief, right? It's a belief that you can find a way to be free. And if you want to be a religious thing, you have to find a way to be free within religion. I don't find it hard to believe that they would agree, but there's a long distance between agreement and understanding. Right. The question I ask you, is this haskama to a collection of shaylot and tshuvot compatible with a list of requirements, technical requirements, right, when you get this and you say, what should one write about art and Judaism, do you think that the answer is you should write a technical treatise of under exactly what circumstances can you depict what kind of representational figures? Whether it be in the realm of eros or animals or human beings or stars. Do you think not so much? What about the rest of you, right? Do you think this fits or not, right? Do you think this fits, or is it a haskama that undermines the whole project? Yes, sir.
I mean, I really appreciate this kind of haskama because I feel like it's not. We talked earlier this week about like the concept of chashad, and right. is it sort of a frozen mechanical institution that we evaluate halacha by things like that, or do we try to apply it to modern situations?
Right.
But I sort of feel like we have to acknowledge that art is something that means something different to both to the artist and to the audience, and the audience of one generation as opposed to another. And I think that this really acknowledges that in a way that I'm not sure halacha is capable or desires to do, or is meant to do.
Uh-huh. So do you think that this is a haskama for a collection of shutim, or a sort of warning shot across the bow?
I personally don't. I think it's a good match because I think that it acknowledges that you need both. That it's not just, it's not, if it's only about halakha, then it doesn't acknowledge that there is an element, like we talked about yesterday, that halakha can't address and isn't meant to address. So I think it's a good combination.
What do you think, Ira?
Well, he's not saying that.
So what do you think he's saying?
What? I don't think he read the book.
You don't think he read the book?
Yeah.
You think if he read the book, he would just say no?
Yeah, but I think the book is exactly the opposite of what he's trying.
He tried to write a social commentary on, like, art history. I'm just confused by it.
This girl out here, like, extraordinarily, like, Jewish and alien, kind of, uses that, and then we're the...
Yeah, of course it is. Is there a book student? Why shouldn't it be straight angle? It's not a...
It strikes me as very difficult to live in that space and not know anything about, the two propositions that came before, if you're going to...
Well, you're supposed to know, right?
I thought you weren't supposed to look at it.
No, you're supposed to know it, but you're supposed to look at it because you need to know it in general. You need to understand its influence, but not to learn from it. Right? As he doesn't want you to study art history because you want to learn to paint like the past.
Uh-huh.
You study art history so you learn not to paint like the past, to understand what went wrong.
Okay, but you definitely have to look at stuff.
Yeah, no, you have to look at stuff. Okay. But you have to look at stuff from a highly critical perspective of the ambition of starting from scratch. Right, you're learning from the mistakes of the past, not the masters of the past.
Okay.
At least, right?
The theoretical audience of this haskava would use the book, would use the rest of the book, and that in that sense they're consistent. But I guess I don't really read that in haskava, so I'm not consistent things that you're going for.
I'm not interested in whether you should have printed Haskama. I'm interested in, here you have what purports to be Haskama for a book, but that is engaged in the kind of project that we purport to be engaged in, right? Because my ambition is that in 3 weeks we'll all be sitting down and writing something like a Shud HaManu'ut. But the question is, is this a call for, oh, guess what? We need more Shutim about HaManu'ut that are just like Shailot and Shuvot about Kashrut. And right, with no qualitative distinction, all we have to do is, right, and in fact, in order to write the halachic books about art, all we need to do is to study the Tshuvot of the past, including those written in Cologne and France, and America and Western Europe, because there's no reason that you couldn't construct a halacha of art simply by extending the rays of the past. Or you could read this entirely different claim. You know what? the halakha of art in the diaspora and the halakha of art in Eretz Yisrael should be totally different things, because the diaspora, you're dealing with a population that has no artistic sense, and so there's no, right, and it has no capacity for authenticity, so there's no reason to create space, and you need to actually put severe constraints on, because nothing can go right anyway, because you're all under either Christian or Islamic influence, so there's no real point in doing it, right, because Jews in the diaspora will only produce Christian and Islamic art anyway, or Western art. But now, in Eretz Yisrael, we need to write a different halakha, which frees people. That's also, right, which of these is he saying? Right, I could see this as, you know, taking the radical position that, you know what, we should discount, basically, everything written after the exile, and start over from the sukkim. Okay. Yes, Kaza.
Is it possible that there are sort of two levels going on here? I mean, the way that he's framing the summit is in a very sort of utopian sense, a very perfected sense, okay? You can say you have sort of a perfect level and a non-perfect level, and if the art is perfect and authentic, and one's faith is perfect, then this applies. If either of those two things are not perfect, then by all means, go ahead and censor it all you want.
Yeah, so I think that the utopian failing of the school on the whole is that it is true that an artist with what the posek considers to be perfect intuition will never perceive the psak as constraining. The question that matters is, what happens if the artist and the posek have different intuitions? Right? What happens if the artist comes up to you and says, I think that in order to properly portray the experience of the Akedah, you need to show the angel this way. And the Posek says, sorry, I need to chop off the tip of that wing.
So that boils down to the fact that there's really no way of evaluating. So you do have these two levels. You have one sort of perfect and the imperfect, but where,
Well, you have three models, right? You have a model which says that Poskim can advise, but artists carry out. You have a model which says that Poskim determine and artists have to deal. And you have a model in which Poskim and artists together are engaged. The production of the halakha of art does not generate the results. It just says, look, this is the outcome of what I think the rules ought to be. Now you go paint. If you tell me that when you tried to paint it came out different, now we need to talk about what the halakha ought to be. Okay. Anyone want to talk on this side of the room? Not yet? No. Okay. Aura, what do you want to say?
Maybe we're saying, okay, this is ideally what art should be, but we have to kind of deconstruct what it was, and in order to reconstruct, we need these two things. Maybe that's the...
It could be. But now ask the question, does he believe that the shukim can be written by non-artists? What would it mean to write it for a non-artist, to write a tshuva about art? Yes, Rachel.
Well, I think then that leads in perfectly to Ion, because it's the whole debate sort of, the scene you referenced from Good Poet Society yesterday, where, there you can make evaluative, criteria in order to understand, is this halakhic or not, is this good art or not, but there is also possibly space made for evaluating it based on a more emotional or intuitive or divine.
Good. So that's a good transition. That's a good transition. Thank you for the segue. Let's try this. Okay. So what you have is a claim, which he doesn't ground, which is that artistic expression is something that is a religious endeavor, right? Such that it's not possible to have a truly live religion without having the absence of an artistic culture is a symptom of a religious failure, and he would see it as a symptom of of an Islamic type religious failure, where you don't have the capacity to understand what it means, where you don't exactly understand what it means to be a human being with senses. The absence of artistic culture?
No. Oh, okay.
The absence of artistic culture.
Artistic culture is a symbol of
religious health. And its absence is a sickness. So we need art. But he doesn't ground he doesn't ground why art per se. He talks about what art per se expresses, but he doesn't talk about why that matters, and he doesn't talk about what the ground of that is. And that yields into that, right? He does talk about what it is that the art ought to express. Right? He tells you what the outcome is. The outcome is an expression of both, right, of the middle ground in which divinity is divine, but the Tzelem Elokim matters, in its corporeal, right? We believe very strongly in an incorporeal God, and in man as a corporeal being that is in God's image, right? And we live with that, right? And we live with that paradox, which he doesn't seem to feel is terribly paradoxical. Then, the question then comes up is, why art? And is art only a means of expression, right? Does art have an epistemological role, right? Is art a way of knowing something? Do artists have ways of knowing things that are not available to those who don't have artistic perception?
Sorry,
yeah.
Can you rephrase that question in other terms? Because I'm not exactly sure if you're saying, because I think this sort of brings us back to, I think someone asked yesterday, what about people who therefore don't have artistic abilities? Are they therefore not able to experience certain...
So that's the same, it's the same kind of question.
Okay.
Right? Say, why is it that in the diaspora,
mm-hmm.
artists were incapable of producing true art? Is it because the poskim couldn't, right, because the proper content, right, they were artists in the same sense that, right, that our artists are, they had the same technical skills
mm-hmm.
as our contemporary artists, right? So really there was nothing about the artist per se that prevented them from doing it. What was lacking was the capacity to give the artist the material. Yes?
We're just going to say that the same epistemological structure is going to give us knowledge both about the divine
and the human. Yeah, we're bracketing that question. We're bracketing that question for now. But the alternative is that it's not, right, that you don't think of galut as all the formal tools were there, but the content was lacking. But you could not be a great artist in the diaspora because to be an artist is to have access to the content directly. True artist has direct access to the content you're expressing.
What is direct access?
Well, okay, so all right, so I'll go back to the. Let's suppose here. Let's here's the way of framing it. Let's suppose you're an artist and you live in 13th century France, and all of a sudden, out of a time machine, here comes Rav Yaakov Ariel,
mm-hmm.
walks into 13th century France, really, it immediately declares, this is the embassy of the State of Israel, so it's extraterritorial, and now Eretz Yisrael is here in France, and he's standing in Eretz Yisrael, and in the 21st century, and he says, now I'm going to tell you what the halakha of art is. And the artist says, oh, cool, and goes off to produce great, authentic Jewish art, because what's been lacking is... Right, what's been lacking is the Torah personality to explain to the artist what it is they're supposed to do. That's one model.
Okay.
A second model is, no, artists don't find out what to do because poskim tell them.
Okay.
Right? An artist in Eretz Yisrael, in authentic Jewish culture, has access to Torah. Not through other people. But has access to Torah. They can express different things because the artist has authority by virtue of their capacity, right, of their artistic capacity. Right? Art has independent epistemological value. Now it may be that text, as with every area of life, right, so the capacity to learn text gives you insight that is useful, right, for conversations with other people who have their own epistemological ways, in the same way, right, that it's useful to know Torah, it may help you understand certain questions in medical ethics, right? But you also need to, you know, but fundamentally, the reason that religion produces great art is not because you view the formal capacities as a field in which you can plant right? Which other right? An artist with formal capacity is a field in which you can, right? In which scholars can plant Torah. But because being an artist, per se, it right gives you insight into all sorts of things. Now that is the tension in the ion, right? Is that if you grant art, so now we go back to the question of art. If you say that the significance of art is exclusively of form, and that art doesn't say anything per se about the, right about things other than form, then you have no problem, right? Because right, if an artist paints a finger, right, we're not claiming thereby that you learned something about anatomy, because it wouldn't matter if this is actually a finger, or if it represents the Aristotelian conception of a finger which is badly mistaken. Right? It doesn't matter to us, right? Because it doesn't, art is not making a claim about correspondence with things. Right? Art refers only to itself. Right? So that's fine. But it's not clear why any such art would relate to Jewish culture, Christian culture, Islamic culture. Why it's not denatured if it has no specific content. If you want to claim that art tells, right? It's only about forms. So forms are... Forms have no historical content, unless they... I would argue, right? We can have this fight. Not now. Right? I understood I was walking into it, right? I think we could have... I think it's a second stage fight. All right, so I want to have the Hakira first, then we can talk about whether the Hakira is legitimate. All right. If art claims authority only over form, and not over forms as right, in any sense other than the... Let's say visual art only claims response over visual forms as forms per se, where the correspondence, the things that exist in the non-perceptual realm is accidental. Then I don't think you need to. It's not a threat. It's not a threat to Torah.
So couldn't form itself pre-content?
Could be. That's the point. That's the point that Chava is making, which I'm trying to bracket for now.
Oh, okay.
Okay. So I'm saying that right. So in theory, I want to suggest, right? Like here you could have it as follows. If art only claims authority over form, so then the challenge then is, why do we care? But unless you want to make the assertion that Torah directly relates to, right, to pure aesthetics, as like, if you want to make the claim that... No, that it really, in addition, right? If you want to make the claim that the formal content of halakha right, controls everything. Right? If you want to believe that halakha tells you how to experience the redness of meat, because let the tar panoyim enter, there shouldn't be any space in human experience that isn't rendered fully meaningful by halakha. Mm. So then, right? So then you have a problem if art claims authority even over that, right?
Mm-hmm.
But since almost nobody claims that there is a halakha as to how to experience the redness of meat,
mm-hmm.
right? This, you know, we can talk about the sunset story of Nish Halakha, right? What does it mean, right? If you experience a sunset as Man Kriya Shema, is not experiencing right, twilight, right? If it experiences the time, it doesn't experience, but it doesn't tell you anything about the colors, right? It means Man Kriya Shema, the meaning of a sunset is the same as whether it's the most boring sunset ever, or a second-rate Turner, or a sunset that nobody has ever successfully painted. Yeah, the reference to a second-rate Turner is from a wonderful essay by Oscar Wilde called *The Art of Lying*, in which the thesis of which is that life imitates art. The obvious example is fashion, where people dress like fashion magazines, not the other way around. Right, so he turns on his head the usual claim that art imitates life, and he says life imitates art. And the comic moment is when he talks about this young woman called me over the other day to the window and said, "Mr. Wilde, this world, you have to see that sunset." And I looked at it, and what was it? A second-rate Turner. It was a famous painter of sunset. Yeah. God could do better than that. Right, but the halachic man's experience of the sunset as set out there in the famous story, the two contradictory sunset stories in Yishalachah, right, doesn't relate to the color. So if you want to claim that halakha has something normative to say about the way in which you should experience color, not just about how color affects Hilchot Nidah or things like that, but the way you experience color. So then, even in that realm, there is an authority conflict between art and halakha. But otherwise, right? Otherwise, the conflict comes more into the conversation we had yesterday, which is we asked the question, we might take the reverse position, which is that halakha doesn't claim the capacity to give meaning to all of human experience. Rather, halakha claims that anything to which it doesn't give value is meaningless. And then the conflict between the authority conflict and halakha and art, there's no conflict about the substance, the question is just whether it's worthwhile, why do we care? Okay? Then there's a third possibility, which is that art doesn't claim authority just over form. It claims that form represents something other than form which is meaningful. Right? It represents different ways of approaching experiences about which halakha unquestionably says things. Okay? And in that claim, then there's a direct authority conflict. Right? If art claims it tells you something about norms. Right? It provides values, right? It tells you something about the value of certain kinds of experience. Right? Then you have a direct conflict within the realm of halakha. Yes.
So I'm just thinking, sort of like when Rabbi Sender on Friday night visited the Josh at your house, where he related,
yeah,
Shakespeare and sort of brought in what could be a secular source into the realm of a Torah point to elaborate on it.
Right.
And I feel like at any time we do something like that, it's always, you could say, okay, we're only going to have a self-referential, exclusively, Bible-based Dvar Torah or whatever, and that's fine, if you want to say that really everything is Torah or everything can relate or address a Torah or be addressed by Torah, that seems to make the world a much more comprehensive.
Yeah, but let's be careful. We're not talking about what you quote in the context of Torah. I'm giving shira on the ion. Right? I don't have any problem with that. The question is, but I can say I give shira on the ion because the ion can help me understand what I ought to say as a Torah personality, but I don't have to give philosophy any authority. Right? Certainly not any authority that can conflict. Philosophy says things about things that Torah says things about, and Torah gets to decide which things the philosophy to pick, right? I'm not granting independent reason any authority. The conflict between Torah and philosophy is never, almost never, right, except in really extreme circumstances, about whether you ought to think philosophically about Torah. It's about whether the process of thinking philosophically has an independent authority, even when it brings you to the substance that is different than you would reach.
Can art be lishma?
Well, this is not a question of lishma. Is the first part, right? Whether there's a value in form per se. But now we're talking about art l'shem Torah, in a sense, right? That if you make the claim that all normative content, which halakha covers, halakha should have, right? Halakha, right, should have exclusive authority. Then you, right? Then you have a challenge. So in the ion, what happens in the ion is that Socrates forces Ion to, and again, you should all read Alan Bloom's magnificent essay on this in Giants and Dwarfs, which again was one of the seminal intellectual moments in my life. I was reading it because I understood the whole Straussian mode of interpretation in a way that I'd always made fun of it. And Alan Bloom, I read this essay and I said, "Wow, this transforms Plato. This transforms every philosophic text I've ever read." Giants and Dwarfs is the collection. So what Plato says to Ion essentially is as follows: if what you do as a performer, right, is a purely formal enterprise, you give beauty, and it happens that you give beauty to Homer, but you have no way of knowing if, right, if it's because Homer means anything or just because these words sound good. Right? You don't have any authority, right, about what Homer really means, or any authority about whether what Homer says is true. None of that, right? You're just engaged in the formal in the formal exercise of declaiming, rhapsodizing. Then that's fine. But why should it matter? So then what you are is an entertainer. Right? There's no reason that anybody should care about what you do. For people to care about what you do, then it has to be that listening to your performance tells them something about what you are reciting about. Right? The painting has to be about more than just the form. It has to be tell you something about the experience of about experience. So what Plato says to Ion, is that if rhapsodizing is simply about the performance of reading poetry, then he has no objection to it, but he also doesn't see the point to it. Who cares if rhapsodizing is about itself? But if rhapsodizing is about the things that rhapsodizing talks about, then there's nothing more important than it. Because it tells you about everything important in life. It tells you about war, it tells you about love, it tells you about God. Right? So if what you're doing is important, then I think what you're doing, right, if you're telling me about something, I think that you're engaged in the most important enterprise in the world if you're doing it well. But on what basis can you claim you're doing it well? You're not a general, right? What you are is a rhapsode. So why should rhapsodes know anything more than rhapsodizing? So, and if that's the case, then all you should do is you should talk nicely about what I tell you to talk about in the way that I tell you to talk about it, and you can put the nice literary frame on it. But your job is to be my propagandist.
That's all on the assumption that content and form are separate?
No, but assumption that the capacity to create form mm-hmm. does not imply any access to content, any privileged access to content.
I would just let you know that in terms of art history and art theory, there are very few people who make that assumption.
I mean, sure, I'm a classicist. I'm just teaching Plato now. Therefore, Plato in the Republic, in the sections that I can give you, right? Plato takes the position that, in fact, the philosophers have to censor the poets. Because what are the poets doing? The poets are just people who tell stories. But what stories they should tell, right? And he has a particular position, which you can debate whether philosophers are good psychologists or not, you know, that they should only depict the beautiful and the noble, right? And only depict gods as being just and things like that, because it will confuse people. If you depict anything else, and this you know, to me that notion, Mark Twain takes care of very nicely, in a two satiric short stories, one called The Good Little Boy and the other called The Bad Little Boy. The Good Little Boy believe all the stories that they are read in Sunday school. So The Good Little Boy, for example, knows that if people break the Sabbath, they will be punished, and so when his friends go stealing apples, and he knows that stealing will be punished. So when his friends go steal apples, he runs into the orchard and says, "Bad people, stop stealing the apples!" And of course, they hear him making noise and run away. And the farmer comes and finds him in the orchard with all the apples on the ground and starts beating him up. And he doesn't understand because he knows that good little boys always get rewarded and bad little boys, you know. And when his friends are planning to sail on a boat on the Sabbath, which is forbidden. So he runs after them saying, "Don't sail on the boat," but they push off just as he's coming and he falls into the water. And all this is deeply theologically confusing for him because the world as religious art has portrayed it to him doesn't allow these things. And similarly, the bad little boy keeps waiting for lightning to strike and being very confused when the Philip Roth story, right, he eats the ham sandwich and keeps waiting, right, he's waiting for God to strike. So it's not at all clear to me that it is wise to send the religious art that way, even if you think that you have complete control over the end. But let's bracket it, right? But I'm not interested right now, probably since we didn't get to read that, in Plato's specific theory of what criteria the art censors ought to use, but rather just the claim, that should be evident claim, is that unless the capacity to produce art entails the capacity to have directly valuable comprehension or apprehension of the content of your arts, then there is no reason that artists should not submit to censors by whoever you believe does have privileged epistemic access, which would be philosophers for Plato, or you might think Talmidei Chachamim for Orthodox Jews. John, what do you want to say? It wasn't him? No. Yes,
say that one more time.
I think the argument of the Ion is, Plato says to Ion, you sing songs about war. That's a really important educative function. People learn about war from your song. And now we could claim that they shouldn't, and we should tell people, you're, right, actually what you do is you put words together, and they talk about something that has a resemblance to what we call war, but it would be a serious mistake for, you, right, for anybody to try and learn a strategy from your depiction, of war. That's one possibility. And then Socrates said to him, fine, you go do that, but I don't care. I won't learn anything that matters to me. What I'll learn about is how to think. If you want, right, if you want to claim that what you're engaged in is valuable, right, then you must tell me that your songs about war teach people things about war. But then I have to ask you, what do you know about war? Now, right, now you could say you know about war because you're a general, you have experience, right? You know about it because that is your craft. But that doesn't seem to be true. You don't know anything about war. And now the argument always lurking, right, always, you know, somewhere, right, close to the surface in Socrates is fundamentally what, right, the thing that really matters, the only thing that really matters about, the only thing that matters to talk about is what is the good. So, right, and if poems are, if your poetry is ultimately about what is the good, then you must be a great philosopher. Because only philosophers know about the good. Okay? Right? Therefore, he says to Ion, all right, you have two choices. Either your work is meaningless, or you're a philosopher. All right, we would say, either your art is meaningless, or you're a Talmid Chacham. Now, if you concede that you're not a Talmid Chacham, and you also want to claim that your work is about something, then you have one other out, which is what Plato gives Ion, is you can claim you're a Navi. Wait a second, right? You know, is that right? That's the Chakira of the Ion. You know, three, either you're saying nothing important, right? You have access unrelated to your capacity as an artist, to information about the good, or you're a Navi. And you're not a Rambam Navi, which is a cheat, you know, where you spend great deals of effort, right? So you're actually a philosopher who achieves Nebuah, right? Because the Rambam won't allow Nevi'im to clash with philosophers either. Right, and right, the Rambam, a Navi is just a higher level of philosopher. Right, but you're a Navi in the sense that Bilam's donkey is a Navi. Right, here all of a sudden God opens your mouth. Right, and that's essentially Socrates forces Ion to say, I am Bilam's donkey. Right, I don't know why God has given this to me. There's nothing about me that prepares me for this role. But here I am. I'm Bilam Zonke, and so my performances matter. Now, that is an option we could take. But the problem is we have a term for this, and the term is Nevuah. Right? So it's not clear whether there is a Jewish epistemic equivalent to the claim of divine inspiration that Socrates allows Ion to make. We could create language like Ruach HaKodesh, right? We could, and this is the advantage of being a cookie, is that you have access to all sorts of metaphysical language that you don't in most other Orthodox traditions, right? Most, you know, if you're a Litvak, so you grow up with this really stark bifurcation, Lo Bashamayim Hi, right, even the Nevi'im are not Rishai L'Chadesh Tavar Me'ata. So in general, right, so one of the bases of at least Misnagdish theology is the banning of the capacity to make normative claims on grounds beyond, right, on grounds other than halakhic knowledge. But what I want to suggest is, right, and Reveriel fudges that. Reveriel fudges that completely because he ends up saying that the artist has to be saying something meaningful about something other than form, It has to be saying something about the richness of human experience as a whole, and something that comes organically from from Jewish identity and the historical experience of the Jewish people. But he doesn't tell you whether that's just in a capacity for expression, for which the capacity to express in that form doesn't give you any authority over what you express. That is still subject entirely to the determination of others, but you should say, Baruch Hashem, you live in a new Israel in which there are Talmidei Chachamim who can tell you properly what to do. Or whether he thinks that being in Israel means that artists now have something resembling Ruach HaKodesh, which gives them direct access to what the Jewish understanding of human experience is, such that if a Talmid Chacham tells them that is wrong, they can say, all right, that's very interesting. And now we have a standoff because we have an epistemological conflict about what human experience is, and your halakha says X, and my artistic experience says Y. And who knows, maybe we'll say Puk Chaza Maya Madavar, right? We'll go out and see which way the people vote. Okay, yes, Rachel.
I'm sorry. Okay, so I just feel like the Ion and our discussion isn't giving attention to the experience of the audience. And I feel like there's a great deal of worth in that, even if there wasn't, you know, a artistic intent in whatever the artist was creating. Even if it was simply form and they're staying away from content, they had no intended meaning at all. Maybe they were doing it as a joke, or they were doing it as satire, but the audience finds great meaning in whatever it is that this artist has, you know, composed, then doesn't that give the art itself meaning?
So here we get to an underlying issue that I'm trying to make in a number of ways, which is the question of whether what one writes or thinks about the relation to halakha and art necessarily depends on artistic theory. Right? So I've been setting up this fairly stark dichotomy, which Chava is resisting, right, as to what art is. And you're setting up a different challenge to it, which is that just because the artist thinks about form doesn't mean people can't derive normative lessons from it in some way. And Rabbi Sender set up an entirely different literary theory in which what art really is supposed to be about is not just about form, but about the nature of representation and images. Right? And what makes art valuable is the extent to which it tells you something about perception, because perception per se and how to approach perception is a religious issue. So the question is whether, on the one hand, we're talking about whether halakha has anything to say about art per se. On the other hand, we're talking about, within the realm of halakha, does aesthetic theory, image theory, all those sorts of things have something to say about halakha, and do I want to impose it? Here's a really simple answer. Let's suppose I believe that the experience, we'll take the crudest version of this. I believe that the experience of beauty is valuable, and I can ground that halakhically in a whole set of ways. Like any other area of halakha, there are trade-offs, and so the experience of beauty is worth something, and not others. Right, so we'll talk about, let's say, you're allowed to schedule yourself, you're allowed to take off half from Seder, half an hour early, in order to go see a beautiful painting. We'll get there. Right? We're not stopping in the middle of my Mishnah. We'll spend a whole year on what that means. But as we're talking about, right, we're talking about whether I'm allowed to schedule the trip to Rabbi Rav under the MFA. Right? So I'm cheating because he'll talk about Torah, I imagine. But can we do that? So let's suppose that I have come to the halakhic conclusion that it is perfectly permissible to schedule half an hour a week to look at a beautiful painting. But that's not the shaila you asked me. The shaila you asked me is, can I take half an hour off to look at Picasso's Guernica? Now, I have looked at Picasso's Guernica. You know what? It's an interesting painting, a powerful painting, but it's not beautiful. So, no, usher, because it's not beautiful to me. Now, you guys may say, I think it's beautiful, so what? People disagree with Poskim about reality all the time. Right? I'm telling you, it's not a beautiful painting. So now there are all sorts of much less crude ways in which we could talk about that. Which Rabbi Sender might say, you know, what it's valuable to look at paintings, but only, right, it's worth time to look at paintings, only valuable paintings, and valuable paintings are paintings that have this kind of irony built into them, but there's no real point in looking at a landscape, a realist landscape, right, which actually, you know, might be pure Avodah Zarah, because it's actually trying to create the illusion in you that you're actually there, and that's what Avodah Zarah is, right? Right. So now we have a literary theory, which has very concrete halakhic consequences. Do I wish to legislate that? Right. So the halakha says that you can only look at, right, you can only spend time, you only look at, period, at landscapes that undermine themselves. Okay, so now for me, now we get back to the original question. For me, no, I have very little interest in meaningless art that that audiences can read themselves into. People can go outside and stare at the patterns, you know, rainbow patterns and gasoline on the sidewalk, instead of going to museums if that's what it's about. So I have little to no interest in art that isn't intentional, unless you want to claim that, again, that the artists are inspired somehow, right? And, you know, and they don't understand what they're doing, but it's really there. If it's all solely about self-discovery, either self-discovery is available through everything, or self-discovery is not worthwhile. I don't have, right? So that's me, right? If you might have a literary theory which says that the goal of art, you know, that active artists do is they produce things that are, you know, they produce, now literally non-artists often do this, they produce funhouse mirrors, which, right? And so the painting doesn't mean anything, but it does, right? But art has the capacity, certain kinds of pieces of art have the capacity to make you look at yourself in ways you didn't before, even though the art means nothing. Right. Now, you might be really convinced of that, and think of art that way. And I might think that actually, no, it does. There's no value to that at all. You might think that what happens if you think that looking at a particular work of art, you look at it and you say, "Ooh, you know, that's Hirhurim." All right. And I look at it and I say, "You know, anyone who thinks of that painting as erotic is completely missing the point." Right, it's really about X. So, do I want a paskin? Right. So, do I want to have a halakha about what kind of erotic images can be painted? When you end up with the, you know, semi-absurdity, right? This is always the problem with censorship things, is that people project their own eroticism onto right. Because to me, like my parade example of a bad moment in Jewish history in this regard is when certain rishonim feel compelled to explain what it meant that she was yifat Torah v'yifat Mareh. Right. It meant that she had, you know, she had black hair, white skin, and ruby lips. That's not good. You shouldn't be afraid, right? That tells you nothing whatsoever about the Torah and everything about, right, and everything about the commentator. Right, we hope a lot about the commentator's wife. But any kind of halakha about that, right, which isn't at the very general level of only look at things that give, right, that make you understand God better and don't make you have usher hirur, right, is not, right, is gonna involve legislating either what you believe to be popular perception or idiosyncratic perception. Okay, yes.
But I feel like, so what if you have a case where there's a, you know, in halakhic terms where there's a stuffing, and we don't, you know, or if you're listening to a concert and the music was composed by someone who's dead, and you don't know if that composer had an intent behind the music, or he just sat down and played some notes and it turned out great. Do we say, well, there's a suffix about whether this had intended meaning or not, therefore we shouldn't go?
Absolutely, right? So the question of when you apply suffix as a category is a really important question in stuff. Right, you tend to apply suffix in cases where you only care about one side, right, or you care about both sides so deeply you're frozen by the values level, mm-hmm. as much as you're frozen on the halakhic level. This is, you know, like, and so I, you know, personally, you know, to the art I produce, such as it is in its limited fashion, you know, it goes in different directions. Mostly it's verbal, and the verbal thing is very much content based. The few moments when I sit down and for some reason find myself doing things visual, they're mostly absolute pure abstractions like madhura. And it's one of the challenges of my life is like why it should matter to me. Why is this line being here and not there, right? Is it am I just completely trivializing myself by erasing it and putting it here because it feels better here? Or am I, you know, engaged in something that in ways I don't understand really, that really matters in the world? And then the question is, how does my suffix about that translate into halakha? And not just halakha for my own life, but if I'm trying to create halakha, so to what degree should other people be bound by my experience, my having successfully experienced Mondrian and not getting anything out of Rothko, say? Whereas Rabbi Sander thinks that everybody should be forced to stand in front of Rothko until they get it. Right? You know, Rabbi Sander described Rothko as painting emotion. Painting pure emotion. We go, what? You can't paint pure emotion. What does that mean? It's just color. Right? You know, and he tells me, I think several times tell me the story of people just standing in front of Rothko and Rothko's and crying. But it's three colors. It doesn't do it for me at all. They're not even at right angles to each other. If they were right angles to each other, I would understand it. They're not even at right angles to each other. So what could they possibly mean? Okay, so that's right here. The summary is, I think Rav Ariel's tshuva sets out a claim. The claim is that this is what art ought to do. The claim is not, right, but it's not an artistic claim. It's a Torah claim. It comes purely from Torah, right? It's not. He didn't set out. Right? It would be cool if somebody's haskama for a work of Shulam Anut was a painting. And you figure out, right? You figure out what he's telling you, right? Everyone should paint like this, right? That would, right? But Rav Ariel didn't paint, right? So, you know, it would be even better, right? If there were haskama, if he had written haskama and then he had written the painting. Or he could have put models of what paintings, you know, were supposed to be. But he doesn't. What he sets out is what art is supposed to do and leaves entirely open the question of whether the capacity of art to do that is something that is a partnership between the content people and the form people. And so there's real value to a shaylim tshuvot that are as precise as possible about art, so that, right, because that will enable artists to do their job better. Or whether he's saying that that part of the return to Israel is that artists now have a form of inspiration, right, which gives them authority over this, and so we should listen to them, although, right, since we also have something to say, so they should listen to us as well. And so we might call, you know, in the old joke, we would say that Yeshud HaManut really, even if it existed, it could only be suggestion. That would be negotiated together. Or the third realm, which is more of what we were arguing about yesterday, is that maybe Rav Ariel's whole enterprise is in error, because actually art is only about form. And then the middle ground, which Chava and Rachel suggested, which is, you know, you might argue that perhaps for Rav Ariel you have to argue something along the lines that the experience of living in Eretz Yisrael changes the way in which you ought to experience, in which you ought to experience the redness of meat, but in ways which in no way affect the areas which halakha has claimed in Galut. So there's no reason that there's no reason to think that there has ever been any halakha about the redness of meat. But it doesn't mean that figuring out what the experience of the redness of meat is invaluable, because maybe it wasn't valuable in Galut, but it's valuable in Israel. So in Israel, all of a sudden, all of human experience becomes valuable again, because now, once again, HaKadosh Baruch Hu has more in his life than the Dalai Lama Halakha. This is the inverse. Somebody told me, Rabbi Lam, getting in trouble because he said that he should read Ein HaKadosh Baruch Hu Be'olamo Dalai Lama Shalakha B'Lavad as a tragedy. Right? And that, I think, is the Rav Kook perception, that, right, that's a symptom, right, brought on by the Qurban, and at the end of the Qurban, then we go back to having, right, to having a rich realm of experience. But that comes from a particular ideological perspective. If you don't think that Zionism changes the world, then this is a much harder argument to make, because there's no reason to assume that we should add, right, if you believe that the experience of Orthodox Judaism for the past 900 years has been basically what it ought to be, except it didn't have political autonomy, so then, okay, so we look at it, we haven't been very productive artistically, what's wrong with that? Right, let's go back to Europe before the emancipation. All right, that looks like a good breaking point. Thank you.
Wait, did you just use the phrase with the end of the
Qurban
on tape?
The end of the Qurban? I don't think I said that. But you said it now. Because I can't figure out how to turn it off yet. It was a trap. I wish I knew.
Stop button. Please play slash stop.
Yeah, you would think so. But
just hold that. Just hold down this button if you want to just turn it off.
Which button?
This one. Just hold that down and it'll turn off. That's just like the automatic shutdown. Usually, yeah. Here, can I see this?